Welcome to the Authors Who Lead podcast. This podcast is dedicated to you, people who want to be inspired by authors, leaders, and the messages they share. This is such an important podcast to us because we help uncover what goes on behind the scenes when authors are writing their book. We talk about the process, we talk about where they get big ideas, and you can listen in on those conversations. We can't wait for you to join us, so let's get started. Hi, everyone. Asul Taronis here for another episode of Authors Who Lead. I have the incredible privilege today to have Natasha Miller here. She isn't your average CEO or your average author or anything, I would say. She sits in the helm of Entire Productions. It's the go-to experience design event and entertainment production company in San Francisco that has been in the Inc. 5000 list for the list of fastest growing companies in America for 3 years in a row, which is amazing during a pandemic, being a company that's trying to thrive during a place with events. Her passion and commitment for giving back drive her and her many contributions and participation in numerous charitable organizations. But not only that, she's also a performing artist, the jazz vocalist, and her music's amazing. She's trained as a classical violinist, and she's very proud of her graduate from Goldman Sachs of 10,000 small businesses, has studied entrepreneurship at the Harvard School of Business and MIT, and is a member of the Recording Academy. If you've heard of the Grammys, that's where this is, where it comes from. And she loves travel. She lives in San Francisco, and she's able to do this work with me here because she is an author, and we're talking about her book, Relentless: Homeless Teen to Achieving the Entrepreneur Dream. Natasha, welcome.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for saying all the things in the bio. I will have to say one thing. You may have made this up. You may have wished this for me. I hate to travel.
Oh.
I hate that's it. Even,
tell me more. Let's start here, because I just read travel and I thought that's what it meant. And I looked at my notes. That's not what it says. It's the name of a company.
Yep. So I am a homebody.
Yeah.
I'm very outgoing. I'm very confident. I'm not shy, but I'm introverted and I'm a homebody. And I'd rather be here living my great life than traipsing off to somewhere else in the world. It makes me a bit shallow and a little weird, but I own it.
Well, thank you for helping me with that. And also, being honest, I'm an introvert and I'm happy on a stage because you're over there. People are over there. They're not near me, taking my energy from me. And I'm a podcast host, but I'm still very much an introvert and I prefer home. But I do travel. I'm learning to do it. My spouse likes to travel, so I get it. But I am very comfortable in my own space, this little space, whatever this is. So I get it completely. I'm really glad to talk about your book today, mainly because of the power that it brings through the storytelling that you do. And so for those of you who are listening, when you get someone in your inbox about a book, you really think through. I read all the books that come my way, so I don't want to lightly choose an author. But when it's Relentless, I just felt like I had to know more. And then your bio, of course. But what really struck me was choosing to write a book about your life when it has a rocky past, even if it has a glowing moment now or in the future, it always feels like a challenge. Tell me what gave you the courage or the impetus to want to write a book about your life, because it starts out pretty rough with mom and a butcher knife and many more explorative comments from mom about you. And so I was wondering, what made you want to write this book?
4 years ago, I was sitting at a conference with a bunch of entrepreneurs, 7 and 8 and 9 figure annual recurring revenue entrepreneurs, learning how to scale and grow our businesses. And one of our mentors was an author, and she listed the things that she could help the people sitting at this table with. And I just had this, it was this energy that came through my toes all the way up through my chest. And I was like radiating. And I was like, oh my God, it just came to me. It's time to tell your story. And I started writing, and it was quite an experience. And I have to tell you that I discovered some things while I was reading it that I would have never discovered had I not started writing the book. And we can go into that a little bit later. But I knew that I had enough distance from some of the most crazy things that were happening. And I was becoming, I had some distance also with the successes that I had created. So it wasn't like I was in the moment and trying to get revenge or trying to hurt anyone. And I think that's so important, right? As a writer, when you're putting out your work, your story, that you're not in a revengeful place, especially by the time it releases. You can start writing that way, but you got to mold and sculpt and reflect and make sure that you're putting out something that's really good for the reader.
Yeah. And that's sharing your truth when you have to say it again. We've lived it in our head and we've tried to distance ourselves from the trauma or challenges. However we decide to frame it. But to be able to return to them, to tell them as they occurred, because you really are reliving the moment.
Mm-hmm. Especially when you're like trying to show, not tell, right? Yeah. I'm like, oh my God, this is all in a journal. Yeah. I've been journaling since 10 years old. We write in essay form when we're writing our story, unless we're like phenomenal writers that do it all day long. And then when challenged with, how are you feeling? What were you wearing? What was it like? Was it, I was like, oh my God, do we really need to like seriously go all the way there?
Right. Yeah. I've helped many authors write memoirs who some were reluctant. I would say they would be like, I don't know that it's time or I want to. I'm like, I'm not telling you, you have to, I'm just wondering what you might say if you told more, and then memoir starts to eke out. I have a strong belief that writing is a transformative process for the author, if they allow it. It can be very academic in nature. We're all trained very much that writing is one word enough the other, and there's a grammatical structure. But to tell your truth, to be honest on the page, that's not something we usually do for others. We usually do it for ourselves. So when you were writing this, obviously, I think you started it during the pandemic, from what I remember. And
I started
was it before?
It before the pandemic, but I had to put it down for some time because of that surprise that I don't want to say on, I want to be able to tease people, but something huge happened in 2019. And there was behaviors happening in my family because of it that made me put down writing. I didn't know if I would ever be able to put the book out. Yeah. I didn't know if I'd ever be able to finish it. And I did focus on finishing it in the pandemic. And I also started figuring out how I was going to publish it and market it. Really, that's what I spent a lot of the time in the pandemic doing.
Yeah. It's harder than people think to market your book because you have to show up again and again. And for the host of a podcast or the media, it's new. And for the authors, like, I can muster up the strength to do this again and maybe a different way, but it is really difficult. Authors usually burn out more than the readership burns out. We're not tired of you, but we're tired of ourselves sometimes. Yeah, I feel like I'm droning on about myself. And memoirs have that built in. When you were writing this book, and you can tell us about your process, if you wrote an ugly, messy draft, did you write it here and there? Did you get help from an editor or coach early on? What was the process
that,
like?
All that you just said, I did. So I wrote, I'm a voracious, I can write forever. Is it wonderful, beautiful, descriptive prose? No, but I'm like prolific. So I wrote 50 to 80,000 words, and the story in itself is already captivating, but my writing wasn't excellent. And I couldn't be consistent in that beautiful craft. And it was very important for me for this book to read like a beautifully written work of fiction, to feel that way to an extent without having to fictionalize anything. Believe me, nothing's fictionalized. I then realized, let me rephrase, my daughter reflected to me that it wasn't going to cut it. It wasn't good enough. And so I went on a hunt for an editor, and I was using the wrong language. I was looking for a ghostwriter. I didn't need a ghostwriter.
Yeah.
Right. And I found the most beautiful human being that I could have ever. It was like the perfect fit. His name is Jamie Blaine. He works with a lot of writers through HarperCollins, but he took my book. He doesn't take a lot because he gets to be picky, choosy. But this is the beautiful part about Jamie. Not only is he a great writer, but he used to be a trauma counselor and he was a musician and he writes for music magazines. So the people listening to this podcast that haven't looked me up, they're probably thinking, so what's the connection? But Asul, you know the connection very well. It was brilliant. And he helped me create that dream of having a really well-written book.
That's amazing. hats off to everyone like Jamie that's in the background that doesn't get shouted out, because they're the ones that make our books shine. They're the, well, they bring the best out of us.
Look at this. His name is on the book.
I noticed that on the cover.
I don't know. You can't really see it, but it's there.
Good. And I really want to thank you for honoring those around us who make
it. A writer. And he could have been work for hire, and I could have never told anyone, but I was so excited about him and our relationship that we built and, you know, what he brought to the book. I couldn't not mention him.
Yeah. No, that's beautiful. Yes. And your book weaves together when you have to arrive in trauma. So for those of you listening, I encourage everyone to go get this book. It is beautifully written, and it is tugging at sometimes at your heart, and it makes you appreciate where you are now, whether wherever you are, because it could be always something else. When you have to share about the traumatic events, especially when they're put on you by people are supposed to care for you, that's when it starts to become really difficult to read. I was a teacher and a principal for 24 years. So I saw
many, kids like me.
Yes.
Yeah.
I went to their homes and I found them alone living in.
One came to my home. So good for you, Esther.
Yeah. Because they wouldn't show up. I'm like, I'm going to their house. I'm going to figure out what's going on. And then to get there, and realize there's no parents there. And there's one chair and there's a kid just surviving. And I was like, this. And then the teachers would be upset because they weren't doing the work. I was like, if that was just. If the work was the problem, the work was the thing that was going to save these young people.
Azul, I want to talk about that right now, because I did not do well in school and I am an excellent learner now. Mm. And my daughter recently said to me, it's amazing you weren't a great student. You're such a great student. Now I'm like, oh, I was just trying to survive. Yeah. I couldn't focus on anything. I was fighting for my life. And all the classes that I was taking, I couldn't be present to even listen to the content, much less connect with the teacher.
I would struggle with when I'd go into a classroom and I'd see teachers try to scold a kid who had their hoodie over. Like, that's their only protection today. Right. That's their only way to make it through. Stop. You're really hurting more than helping. And I can only do so much as far as even being the principal. There's only so many days, hours and day. But what I have observed when I was the teacher is that kids tell you exactly what they need if you listen, but they're not going to tell you in words adults say. They're going to show you and do things, and they're going to say things, but they're trying to help you understand what they need. And so many times in the stories that I hear in works that are like yours, I see the children that I served, and my first sixth graders are now 41, I think, this year. Like, it's a long time ago I always was able to see them. And I think that's what made me not a great teacher, but made me a pretty good person. I was not the greatest teacher because I didn't care about grammar and words. I was an English teacher, but I'm dyslexic and I can't write really well, which is ironic that I'm a book coach and that I became a teacher. But it's about what's beneath the surface. And your story goes into some really amazing things. So not to give it all away, but I do want people to know why they should read it, is that you go from a really challenging relationship with your family. Both dad was struggling with alcoholism. Your mother was a bit of a tyrant, to be kind, and threatening and very abusive. And you end up being removed from your home, involuntary on your part, but really to save your life in some ways, because it was a really terrible situation. Yeah. You end up in a homeless shelter placed there by your own father.
Yeah, I was abandoned by my family.
Yeah.
At a homeless shelter at the age of 16 on Christmas Day night.
Yeah. I just sat there thinking of you in that shelter when you gave your sweater away, and thinking of Philip and thinking, holy crap, what? How can we go up from here? I was like, there's got to be an up from here.
The up took a while.
But despite that, what was happening for you along the side, there were some people that saw the spark of opportunity, possibility, because you started to play the violin at a very young age as well. And you had innate skill and talent and interest in it. Tell us a little bit more about how the music started to give you hope. Maybe if it wasn't in what was happening in your actual life, but it was through music, at least in that moment.
Yeah, the music for me was, it both created my life and it saved my life. And if I didn't have that, I don't know if we'd be talking today. So I was encouraged. And the teachers, I've actually, Diane Pope, the conductor that I talk about in the book, I talk to her to this day. She didn't know what was happening.
Yeah.
And she still, you know, she ushered me into a really high performing potential with getting me to take lessons with a college professor in seventh grade. So that was a big push by the angels, right?
Yeah.
And the music was a way for me to express myself. It was a way for me to be safe. When you have to practice for 4 to 6 hours for a lesson, you can seclude yourself. And for some reason, my mother didn't bother me while I was practicing. So as long as I was playing the violin, I wasn't being abused. But as soon as I stopped, so that you can imagine, that is a good way to get good at something is to make sure that it, and then it got me attention. And honestly, I was trying to be the best violinist I could possibly be so that I could attract the love and attention of my neighbors or my teachers for someone to come into my house and save me. It never happened, but that's what I was doing.
Yeah. You could tell from the way you described the moments with the book that you were looking for anyone to come, your next door neighbors, those doctors that rented the house next door, anybody to notice. Yeah. But the moment they got a whiff of what was really going on, they seemed to run like, oh, this is more than we could handle, more than a therapist. I remember that junior therapist or whatever who said, this is more than I can handle.
How humiliating would that have been? It was not good.
Not good.
Yeah.
No, challenging that someone would bring those kinds of things there. You talked about very destructive behaviors that you were the opposite of the violin, picking at scabs and really the form of self-harm just to get away from the things that were happening. When you were writing about these things, how did you observe your feelings, emotions show up for you as an adult? Because this is removed, but it still lives in us. It's deep in there somewhere. And even if we've worked on it, still have residual things that kind of pop up. What were the things that you were wrestling through as you were arriving to re-describe some of these moments?
I want to say that you are the first person that has interviewed me out of almost 100 people that has brought that up. And I applaud you because I think it is such a shameful, the self-harm and the way I wrote about it, it's pretty shameful. And I literally remember saying to Jamie, when I submitted that to him, I'm like, have I gone too far? Do you still want to work with me? Is this too much? And he said, this right here is going to prove to people they can trust you. You got to keep it in.
Yeah.
And it gives me shivers right now to think about it because I've been waiting for someone to bring it up and not one person has brought it up. They may have wanted to, but I will tell you, it was really hard for me to write. And I do write in quite, it's pretty descriptive and people reading it might be thinking, yeah, there's something wrong with her. Yeah, there was, and there still is plenty of things wrong with me. So let's not say that I made it out completely fixed, but I needed to put that in there. And you know what? I'm helping give people a voice that do self-harm to themselves or parents that are reading it have come up to me and said, Natasha, I have a 14-year-old daughter who's cutting herself. They wouldn't say that to me. They wouldn't say that to anyone if they weren't given the permission. And that's what this book is about. And I didn't understand completely the responsibility and the privilege that I now have. It's all becoming more and more clear. This book is much bigger than me and my story.
Absolutely. The vulnerability of the telling is already hard enough. For those who've endured hard things and great things, to us is ordinary because it's our life. We don't know anything else. Like we can't say what it would be like not to have this experience. So it's really difficult. But when you start to relive them and show up for them and let them teach you and or free you, man, it's not easy as an author because you have a choice to make. Do I get honest here or do I? It's easy sometimes even talk about the bigger things than it is to talk about those moments where you're the shame.
I did everything in there though. There are some secrets and things that you don't have to splurge. You don't have to put everything in your book to make an impact. And there are some things that are special and maybe I'm not ready to put out there yet that I might feel more comfortable talking about one-on-one.
Yeah. Yeah. No, but I felt and I sensed, I saw you in that moment. And I just wanted you to know that because I know it wasn't easy to write.
Yeah.
And you know, when there's attachments to those things and you don't share them, there's even more shame attached. Like, I can't talk because no one's going to accept me. I don't want people to know. I'd rather perform and prove that I'm okay now to ourselves, to others. So I want to applaud you, because that is one of the moments that we felt connected to you as a human. And that's what I want you all who are listening. When you are trying to tell the truth, we're not looking for everything. We don't need every piece of thing, garbage, trash, whatever you want to call it, air your dirty laundry out there. But we need you to be honest and vulnerable so we can trust you, because we have the same stuff in our closet that we're afraid that people will judge us for. And the moment you let us into a world that we don't feel like we're able to get into, we felt accepted. So that's what you did. A beautiful job. Thank you so much for your vulnerability there. And, you know, I used to see this in my students and stuff. And I had one of my students, I don't know how she is, 27 years old. She reached out to me on LinkedIn. I don't hear from a lot of my students. I taught all over the world, but inner city was my favorite place to teach because I feel like they needed me more, but it wasn't necessarily true. Maybe I needed them more. But one student wrote me on LinkedIn and she said, "I just want to tell you something." I was like, "Okay, yeah." She said, "I remember that I wouldn't do work and I wouldn't talk. And you made me sit in your office at lunch because I didn't have any friends. And so you made me sit in the office as if I was supposed to do something, but you never gave me anything to do. And all I knew you were doing is you were giving me a safe place. You would let me draw and express myself, but I had nothing I had to do. And I want to thank you for that." And it wasn't any of the things I ever taught, because do you really remember, maybe in a violin or some specific skill, but she remembered being seen. And I think that's right. What I felt like. I want you to feel seen because I see you, and I appreciated that part of the book. It's really powerful. Amazing. As you started to grow, if it were just I was kicked out by my family and put in a homeless shelter by my own family, where all these other abandoned youths were, you decided that you're going to get yourself out of it. You're like, "Oh, I realize I'm not a ward of the state. I'm not stuck here. I can get out if I want." And you got out, but you needed a place to live. You're in high school. You got a job working whatever you could, found a basement apartment for $150 or something like that, from what I remember. And you're having to learn to live, coming from a chaotic household where there was no order, no structure, anything, and then to all of a sudden be responsible for yourself. What was that like, having to return to that moment? Because you have a daughter now, you realize, oh my gosh, I can't imagine putting my daughter in that situation at this moment.
You know what? I've been raising my daughter like I needed, like I wish I would have been raised. So she knows way more than she should know at every stage of her life. I'm like, "Okay, if you ever need to," I taught her how to drive at the age of 9. "If you ever need to get into a car and drive away," what the heck is that about? She was not driving on her own at that time, but she knew how. She had been in the car in a giant parking lot. And we're talking about, I flipped on the light switch and the lights didn't come on. I was like, "Oh, are they broken? Is there a light bulb out?" I had no idea that you had to call the electricity company, and that furthermore, you needed to have credit. And furthermore, you needed to put a deposit down. This is back in the day. I don't know. Maybe it's that way now too. But I was too busy surviving to be flabbergasted by that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's the whole notion of the book, the relentlessness of the way the world was coming at you and the way you were responding to it. So watching that unfold, and you're 16 and you're trying to make your way, you still continue to play music.
Yeah.
And I remember when in the book where you're talking about the relationship you had with these universities, you would nail the audition, get in, get a full ride. And then if you didn't like what they were saying, or you weren't happy with them, you're like, "I'm just going to do something else." And I thought, "Oh, this is the relentless theme. It's showing up again and again, wherever we go in the story." Yeah. And so as somebody who became and is a very accomplished musician, performer, who didn't graduate college the way other people might think you should, but you continued to return there because there was some, I think you were really appreciated there from the start. Like, you really were seen as, this is maybe who I am. It was like, I always felt like this question mark. What was it like being able to find your gift and then move around? Because you were a violinist and that's how you were doing well, but you really wanted to be a vocalist. Tell us how that was happening for you in the book.
I think I might've known that the more I would excel in music on the violin, that would eventually lead me to being able to be a singer. I was always a singer, but I was known and revered as a violinist. By the way, I was fairly good, but we're talking the Midwest here. Let's not get too excited. Like maybe when I was in fourth grade, people in Des Moines, Iowa at Perkins Elementary considered me a prodigy, but sat next to other people that were really, you know, a prodigy. No, I don't think I had that. I had the heart and the soul of a prodigy, but maybe not the mechanics.
Yeah.
I don't know. I look at that. I think it was my roadmap to becoming a professional singer. All I wanted to do was sing.
Yeah.
So I used it as a tool, a stepping stone to get there.
Yeah. That's what even in the relationships, I felt like you were like, nope, this isn't it. Stayed in it for a while. Not the thing you pulled out. It really wasn't just in one area that you're relentless occurred. It was like in every facet of your life, even in your career. We'll talk about that in a little bit.
Even today.
I'm certain that as we get closer to the now, right?
Yeah.
I see that still in, and as you talked about towards the end of the book, that how you were trying to pivot in an entertainment company that puts on live events during a pandemic. I was like, oh my God, this is a second book, please. This one for any of us. But what I saw in there is that as you started to, I think you didn't settle in the book. You started, and this is your life. It's weird having someone talk about your life on the exterior, but you really wanted to have this opportunity to be a vocalist. You wanted to sing. You wanted to share your voice, and you started to find some success in it, singing at different venues. And you talk about this beautiful moment where you found this opportunity to sing for this beautiful, I think she was an opera singer. I got to remember if that.
Oh yeah, Flicka.
Flicka.
Fabrika.
And you were invited to this beautiful place, her home, to sing as a way to warm up the audience, for lack of a better word. And you were there. And you describe this surreal moment where you're singing for this woman who is just a songbird, like just known for this voice. And you find her in that moment. And then she praises you in front of her entire audience. Tell us about that moment, because I had a feeling you could probably write that moment for a lot longer than you did. But I felt this sense of pride of this person that you watched really grow up on the page to have that moment happen. Tell us about that moment and what it was like for you.
It felt like a Cinderella moment, like I was in this beautiful bubble floating, and she's such a beautiful soul and so authentic, and she could have been putting it on. Thank you so much for performing. But I could tell she really liked what was coming out of my body, out of my voice.
Yeah.
And it wasn't classical or opera, so I was a little confused. Mm-hmm. I know her a lot better now, and I understand that she actually likes pop music and Broadway and such, but a lot of classical musicians don't. So the feelings were elation, pride. I definitely was being seen. And not only was I being seen by her, I was being seen by her in front of very important people, whatever that means. I couldn't even tell you who was there, but they were adults. And yes, I was an adult, but I was very young, and they were successful in their own right because they were there for a fundraiser for something in the schools. So that was a check mark.
Yeah.
For me, you are valid. There's a reason why you should be here.
Yeah. It felt like the turn in the moment where you went from people praising you for your violin and your gift and your hard work. I would definitely say that it was the hard work you put in as well, but then this, I don't know, blossoming gift that you hadn't yet shown in a way to have that praise, because you had praise early on with the violin and with the professors, and they were paying attention and they saw you in one way. But to see you in the book, when you started talking about it, I could feel the shift. And also then the longing, like, oh, this is what I want.
Yes. And I had to move to San Francisco. I had to move out of Iowa to shed the, oh, she's a violinist. Yeah. I had to move. I was Tosh or Tasha, the violinist, my whole life in Des Moines, Iowa. And I moved to San Francisco and I became Natasha, the vocalist and the entrepreneur.
Yeah. Isn't it interesting that even that shift in our own identity can make a big difference, whether it's a little bit bestowed from others because we give them permission. Even the name, as you mentioned, being called one name to another. I was called Blue my whole life. That's my name. My mom named me Blue. Right.
Yeah.
But I didn't use the name Azul because my dad's the one that put it on the birth certificate. He couldn't stand that my mom wanted Blue and he wanted to have Azul. So she still has never called me Azul my whole life because that's not my name. But when I took on that name Azul, I left my small town. To me, Santa Cruz was a small town. And when I moved to LA, I felt like I had a new persona. I had a new chance to let go of who I was, who people thought I was, even who I thought I was, to create a new life, for lack of a better word. And there's a really great opportunity when we do that. And you said something really powerful. You said a lot of powerful things, but I wrote down the quote because I wanted to talk about it. You said, perfection is sterile. It's not human. It's not emotional, but excellence is something we all can do. And I thought, that's really great advice for authors, creators of all kinds, because you're not trying to be perfect. You're trying to be as close to the best you can be, which is excellence, as you can. And I felt that was what that moment felt like. I think I got here. I think I arrived, whatever that meant. And then you had another beautiful time in the story. There were up and downs, right? There, I want you to all read, but there are moments where marriages lasted, marriages didn't. Things weren't all rosy as you had hoped. Getting to San Francisco seemed like it was a huge shift out of Midwest, out of the town where you grew up. But then you talk about in the book that you meet this amazing connection with Bobby Sharp. And you talk about this revival of an era of music that actually sat pretty stagnant for a while. And you talk about your connection to him. Share a little bit about that moment, because I felt like that was also another turning moment where it felt like
definitely
magic was happening.
Yes. Bobby Sharp was listening to me give an interview at KCSM 91.1, the jazz station here. And he called me up because that's what Bobby does. But I didn't know that at the time. And he was 79 years old at this point in his life. And this is before like the internet was you couldn't really look up people as much as you could now. And he wanted to connect with me. And I had doubts about him because there were people in my life that came up and said, hey, I have a song that I'd like you to sing. Will you check it out? And they like, were not really my thing, for lack of better words. But he also is relentless. And he made sure that before that phone call was over, I knew who he was and what he had done so that I would pay attention to him. I may have learned some extra lessons on being relentless from Bobby Sharp.
Yeah.
That really became a 10-year partnership with, I think I say this in the book, this is a non-romantic, what do you call it when you, oh God, now I'm forgetting the words.
Platonic?
It was platonic, non-romantic, soulmate.
Oh, sorry.
He was my soulmate. And man, we did some great things. He really pulled me out of a really negative and hard situation. And I didn't realize until it was reflected back to me that I was pulling him out of sort of boredom and into the spotlight again.
Yeah.
After 40 years of being dormant. And that was an exciting 10 years.
Yeah. I think that the song, when you mentioned the song Unchained Heart, I was like, oh my gosh, that's Bobby Sharp. My heart sank because I didn't discover jazz until I was later in life, until I was at university. Cause I don't know. I just felt like I was a little bit sheltered. I didn't even, besides the smooth jazz stuff on the radio, I never really had heard jazz until a friend was talking about his jazz collection, and it didn't really resonate with me. We're college kids, but he said, you really need to listen to this Miles Davis album. I don't know. And he turned out the lights, made me lay down on the ground. And I thought, this is the weirdest college moment.
That's how you listen to Miles.
Oh my God. It just filled my soul. And from then I started to like search and learn and want to know. Yeah. So when I heard that song, I was like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. Like the connection, the opportunity that happens. And that moment was so serendipitous, and that it brought together two potentially maybe soulmates, because you were two lost souls in some ways that came together to create this amazing moment. You went on to make music together. Mm-hmm. You recorded his a lot of his songs, some that weren't even produced before. And it seemed like it gave you like a new push and revitalized life in around jazz music. And you performed, you talked about in the book, performing right in front of Clint Eastwood, because he's a big jazz enthusiast, and what that was like. And the whole way that you showed Bobby's love for you and for the way you love music and your life, and how charitable and giving he was, which is amazing for somebody who didn't have to be, right? Could have slipped into oblivion and not cared at 79. Tell us how that impacted you as you, I think passed, I think in 2013. So it's been some time now. How has that impacted you to this day, having that sort of mentorship relationship?
It reminds me of how special that is. And it reminds me that my acknowledgement of other people and my encouragement of other people, my giving back is really important. Bobby liked to hand out $2 to $5 a person in West Oakland to the homeless. And a lot of people walk by people and don't look at them, but that can make a big impact on somebody's day. And verbally saying things to people that are authentic, that are positive, can really help them. And Bobby took it to such another level, not only with me, but with everybody else, but with me especially, that people like he and Flicka really helped mold and sculpt and shape the adult that I was becoming. And I met Flicka when I was probably 25 or six. I met Bobby when I was 35. And you can still be growing into who you are becoming at that age. I'm 51 now. I'm still growing into who I'm becoming.
Yeah.
And so I think learning from him and Flicka and Diane Pope, some of these characters and the real people in the story, have helped me become a better version of myself that I might not have become had I not seen their graciousness.
Yeah, exactly. You were both the angel you each needed, which is, in that case, was such a powerful moment. Did you ever worry, and I'm saying this as a parent, maybe this is my own projection, so forgive me, that, God, I hope I don't screw up my kids. Like, I hope I don't have any residual stuff that just comes out. I'm not paying attention. I don't notice. And then I feel like I could err on the side of the other side, trying too hard. Like,
I have overcorrected to the point where with Bennett, it's not that I've done her harm, but I've overprotected her. And I can see now, she can see as well. She can see it clear as day. She uses it to her advantage sometimes also. But I did write about when I was pregnant with her, I was terrified that I would be abusive to her, that I'd be a horrible mother. And I was given permission by a therapist, thank God for her. Whether she believed it or not, it didn't matter. I left there after three sessions. She said, Natasha, you're not going to hurt your baby. You're going to be a good mom. That's really all I needed. And honestly, I will say to this day, and Bennett, my daughter, will attest, I was really a good mom. I was non-traditional. I spelled things out to maybe a little earlier than normal. I was very honest. I was very loving. I did try to protect her though, and I still do to this day. And that's where I've overcorrected. Yeah. I don't feel comfortable letting her fail or feel bad or helping myself, right? Yeah. I'm helping my old self when I'm trying to help her, but I know I need to let her experience these things because it would be doing her a disservice for her not to know. Yeah. So I'm battling myself all the time, but I didn't realize that. I don't know until like maybe the last 6 years, too late, because now she's been brought up by this mother who did not want her to feel any sort of discomfort. That's not natural.
Yeah.
I think she's going to be okay, but.
Yeah, I'm sure she's going to be okay. I remember I was sitting in a therapist's office at one of the lowest points I had lost. I started a gym. One of the things you do when you're a principal, why not? My drug of choice was work. I worked and being dyslexic and not being very good at school and not being able to read at third grade and flunking freshman English at UCLA just meant I had to work harder. But work was my numbing agent, for lack of a better way to describe it. So I had a lot of success, but one of the things I was afraid of that I would pour that onto my kids, that they had to be successful. I was using it as a way to survive, and I didn't want them to think that they had to overperform. So I definitely relate to that, a little guarding and protecting. And then I was definitely the parent that gave my kids condoms at a way too young of age, probably, and they were telling their friends. And yes, of course, you can have wine at dinner if you want. It's usual, but like, it's just liquid. Don't get attached to it. Like, just, I don't know. I just didn't want them to live the life that I had experienced. Yeah. But what I find is I do see myself when I write about these things. I was like, oh, did I do that? That's who I am. And I felt like there's so many beautiful moments where I was wondering if you had those epiphanies while you're writing those things, if there was places where you noticed things that you didn't see before.
while I was writing, while I was editing, while the trusted readers were reading it, and continues day to day to hear people's feedback. I'm like, oh my God, it's such a mirror, the reflection after the book has come out.
Yeah.
It's like the gift that's going to keep giving forever is different people's vantage points.
Yeah.
And then shining the mirror. And I'm like, oh God. Okay. Yep.
Yeah. Well, I share all these round, all these things so that people understand that I think a lot of people could easily dive into the current success of your multi-million dollar company and working with all these amazing corporations and how going to the Grammys and sitting in the audience and working with these amazing musicians and could easily overshadow, I think, these other things that I think are equally as important. And you said something so beautiful. And the reason I want to share this quote from you is that it sums up, as we finish up this chat, is about where you are now, which is adversity wrecks as many as it saves. And success can be just as disappointing as failure. It ruins one and stirs another one to rise above. And I was like, oh, that should be on a t-shirt. That is beautiful. I'm going to definitely tweet out that after this. But so I wanted people to know there are plenty of people who've succumbed and fallen because of the hardship they've experienced, and others rise above, and they're the same. Maybe they're very similar experiences. Maybe they've been even siblings in the same situation, but one rose and one collapsed. How did you find the strength to keep pushing through? Because you've run a very successful company. That's what a lot of people have known for you more recently, is the great success of this entertainment company. Tell us about how that plays into now with all this life that you brought from sharing your early life into it. How does that now reflect in your business?
As that multi-million dollar business went to a hard zero in March of 2020. And the first thought I had was, oh my God, I'm going to be homeless. Not remembering that I'd built a lifetime of incredibly huge skills that I can use to rebuild my life. That's not the first thought that I thought. But once I got over that, that relentless tenacity within inside of myself helped me recover. And I'm my best self in a challenge. I say that with pride, but also it's pretty sad. And the other part of that quote that you talked about is that I didn't realize that success could feel as sometimes as stressful as failure or sadness. And I was very perplexed as to why I was feeling anxious or why I was feeling sometimes a little bit depressed if these great things were happening. So that was an eye-opener. And maybe as you get older, you realize that.
Yeah.
In general. But those two things, there's a lot of friction, right, around the relentlessness that I have and the fire in my belly to just forge forward. That is what I do. Like, you put a stop sign in front of me and I'm like, thank you. I'm going to figure out 9, if not 48 ways through that stop sign, and nothing is going to stop me. Now, I don't do things illegally or meanfully. I don't have to, right? Yeah. If I don't see it immediately, I uncover every possibility around it. That's my survival technique.
Yeah.
And adversity. I don't know, I'd have to go through a lot of therapy to like dumb that down or mute it. I don't know if I want to. Pretty helpful.
It's been helpful. Yeah. The tenacity, the relentlessness is helpful in times.
Yeah.
And I think that's what I saw in the relationship with you and Bobby in the book, is that I think he experienced that failure can suck ass at times and steal away everything that you thought you wanted or showed up for you. And it can also then give you the life that you were looking for. They're the same different side of the same coin, right? They're so similar. If there's anybody that can teach you how to prosper in adversity, it would be you. I am a huge fan of your authorship as well as your music. And this has been an incredible journey. I want to inspire and encourage everyone to read Relentless. It's a book that I will continue to recommend to people who think that life might be hard, but there's always a hopeful next moment. I really appreciate you being here. If there's any piece of advice you give somebody who's contemplating, thinking about writing their story or their truth, they're not sure if they can or they should, what advice would you give them?
I would caution people to make sure that they're ready, right? To begin writing your story anytime. Do it it can bring up some stuff that's hard to deal with, but it's probably good. Releasing the book is a whole nother thing. And there, I think there is a time to do it and a time not to do it. And you have to really look at yourself and what you're prepared to experience. But I think there's our true stories are so important in the world. And I know that I've never experienced anything more satisfying than having people thank me or say they relate to me or ask me questions that they would never dare to ask somebody else. I now know that I have a new purpose in life. And so for those of you that are thinking about writing a book, consider what I'm experiencing and see if that's a good fit for you.
Amazing. Great advice. Where would people connect with you? Of course, we'll send them to get your book, Relentless. We'll put it in the show notes. We want everyone to buy it and please review it. It's more important than you think. But
I know,
what else?
I'd like to get 100 reviews on Amazon. It's like pulling teeth. I don't know if I could pay people. I know you can't, but I even think if I did, it would be a challenge, but that's okay. OfficialNatashaMiller.com is my website. You can get to the Amazon bookstore and the Kobo and all the other ones from there. But I do want to say, Asul, as I told you earlier, I'd love for you to read the book, but I'd really love for you to listen to it because it has my music woven throughout. But bigger than that, okay, here's a big ask. I can't wait to hear from a person that said, I read your book while listening to it on Audible.
Oh, that's cool.
That's my dream. So somebody... please.
I can tell you that I'll be one of them, but hopefully others will do the same. Amazing book. Definitely worth your attention and read. Thank you so much, Natasha. This has been such a pleasure. I really respect and admire you for your work and for your ability to tell your truth.
Thank you so much. It was great to meet you and to have this conversation.
My pleasure. Thank you for listening again to another episode of Authors Who Lead. We appreciate you being here and we hope you subscribe so you get this delivered to your device every week. And if you haven't left us a review, please do so. It really helps. And if you have a book in your heart, you've been wanting to write a book, please go to authorswholead.com and join us on this journey of becoming a published author.